From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 455, Chef, PowerShell, and DSC with guest Stephen Murawski. Recorded Monday, December 14th, 2015. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks so much for listening to Run As Radio. Hope you're enjoying the new website as much as I am. And we're also going out to all the social medias these days. Every show is being posted to Facebook, Google Plus, and LinkedIn. And if you comment there on any of the shows or on the Run As Radio site itself, we will send you the fancy new Run As Radio mug. So get involved, and we'll make it worth your while. Today, my guest is Stephen Murawski. And his short bio says he's a software development engineer on the community engineering team at Chef and a Microsoft Cloud and Data Center Management MVP. He's active in Chef, PowerShell, and DevOps communities locally and online. I'm sorry, software development engineer? What has happened to you? You used to be a perfectly civilized operations guy.
I was. And then at the beginning of this past year, I got reclassified. I was told, go forth and develop software. And so it changed my role slightly. But for the most part, I'm still doing a lot of what I did when I first came to Chef, though it's slightly different than when I was working in operations day to day.
Are you writing the code, or are you supervising folks that are writing code?
Yes. So I'm actively writing code. My team is responsible for a lot of the stuff that we have in the open source space.
Okay.
And for interacting in an open source manner. So we help triage issues on GitHub and deal with pull requests and get people active and want to contribute to file issues and stuff like that, as well as work on features. One of the guys on my team does a lot of core Chef development. I've been doing some stuff for Chef Client, for some of our testing ecosystem tools, some of our cookbooks. So basically, if it's in our open source space, which in the Chef ecosystem is a lot of things, I can work on it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it brings back to the reality that Chef is an open source project, mm-hmm. and that anybody can contribute to it, really. But it's just, I'm teasing you because you're supposed to be an operations guy, and here you are writing code. Are the contributors to the project also sort of straddling that line that way?
Very often, yeah. In fact, a good number of the developers, at least a lot of the early founding members of Chef software, came from sysadmin backgrounds. The guy who initially wrote Chef came from an operations background, and lead engineer on our ecosystem engineering team. Those are the guys who focus on different platforms we support, and they're doing a lot of Windows work right now. He was a Windows admin back in the day. And, so we also have developers who were, development is what they've done.
Right.
But we do have a good number of folks who come from an operations background who are software developers as well.
So I'm just poking around on GitHub and looking at your contributors list. I mean, it's hundreds of contributors, but I got to think the ones at the top 10 are Chef employees.
I'm just scanning through right now, and yeah, pretty much, there's one there listed there, Fujin. He's a community member.
Wow.
And
yeah, number 9. I mean, and look at his contributions way at the beginning of the project too, in 2008, 2009.
Yep. He's one of our, he's one of the maintainers of our, so in the Chef ecosystem, we actually manage the Chef project in an open source fashion. And so we have weekly meetings where we debate the Chef RFCs. So anybody can create an RFC, and it will get debated amongst the community. And that helps guide the direction of where Chef the project goes. Hmm. And so, there'll be things anywhere from how Chef Client is to what exit codes Chef Client's to use, to more conceptual things like, how do hugs operate in the chef community? And so, I mean, from down technical to more, you know, general pattern and practice kind of things. Mm-hmm. But, the RFC process is open to anybody. And so part of that RFC process, one of those RFCs is how we maintain the chef project and who has commit rights to the chef code base. And so those are maintainers. And there's a structure of maintainers and lieutenants and project leads and stuff like that. But what it boils down to is if you want commit rights into the chef software, there's a process to get that. Mm-hmm. And part of that becomes you become a maintainer for the project. And therefore you commit to kind of help review pull requests and do stuff like that. But it's usually focused on a particular subsystem. Like I'm a maintainer for the Windows subsystem as well as the core chef application. And then there's people who watch out for BSD and Red Hat Linux and all the various platforms that we run on. And a number of these folks don't work for Chef Software, but they have commit rights to changing the core code for Chef.
That's kind of amazing when you think about it.
It gets even crazier. So as part of this RFC process, Adam Jacobs, who's the founder and CTO of the company, who wrote the stuff initially, he is kind of the decider in chief in the RFC process. So he has ultimate veto power and ultimate
somebody needs to be dictator for life, right? I mean, that's just the reality.
But early on this year, he was going on vacation. And so he asked one of our community members to fill in that role for a month. Hmm. So for a month earlier this year, John Cowie, who's an engineer at Etsy, was the decider in chief for all things Chef.
Wow.
Now, it wasn't how the Chef software company ran. It was for direction for the Chef project, but he had full authority to do things for the Chef project, and he doesn't work for Chef.
Interesting that he chose someone outside of the organization, too.
Part of that was symbolic in the standpoint of, you know, this is a community project. It's not just Chef software. And the other part is John really knows Chef. He knows the internals of it. He wrote the book on customizing Chef for O'Reilly.
So he's actually the right guy, too. He just doesn't happen to work for the company.
Correct. Yep. He was one of the right guys to do that. And we've rotated that to some other people as well through the year. Most notably, my engineering lead has had that ability. The idea behind it is we are a community project. Just because you don't work for Chef Software doesn't mean you can't have a say in the direction of where Chef goes.
Interesting.
And, you know, you're talking about committers and that there's a huge array of them. We had a 7-year-old commit, our youngest committer is a 7-year-old female, who is a daughter of one of our community members. And she found a documentation bug and submitted a pull request to fix it, which we accepted.
That's awesome.
So, you don't necessarily have to be a master Ruby programmer to submit code or to submit a pull request or a documentation fix or something like that. I'm very new to Ruby. You know, I've been doing Ruby for about a year now, and I'm still able to commit to the project. We had people who learned Ruby just enough to submit a bug fix, and we'll take that stuff.
Well, and Ruby's also the scripting language of Chef. If you're going to use Chef, you do need to know some Ruby.
Yeah, it's actually very minimal, and For a lot of the folks I talk to are PowerShell guys, right?
Right.
And so when you take PowerShell desired state configuration, you put it side by side with a Chef recipe.
Yep.
It's very, very similar.
That's what I would think too.
Because for the most part, when you're representing the state of a system, it's a lot of key value pairs. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have a property on one side, a value on the other. And maybe there's a little bit of ceremony around how you separate the different resources themselves, or how things are, you know, if you use an equal sign or just a space in between things. But that's all relatively minimal. You know, with no Ruby experience, if you've looked at PowerShell desired state configuration, you can go look at most Chef recipes and get a good idea of what's going on. So that made it actually pretty easy for me to ramp up on Chef when I first started. And you know, the more comfort people have with PowerShell and desired state configuration, the easier that transition becomes.
And that's a big statement, too, because I don't know that that many people are comfortable with that set of tools either. This is a pretty new part of PowerShell.
Yes, it is, but there is a huge level of interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because desired state configuration kind of takes the promise of PowerShell and kicks it up a notch, and it solves a real pain point that people are having. And that's configuration drift on systems.
Sure.
And managing how do we, you know, how do we document what our systems look like, and how do we get things so that they're in a consistent state? And that's the, you know, that's the problem that PowerShell DSC kind of speaks to the heart of. And you don't have to be a super strong PowerShell scripter to get your hands around desired state configuration. Because again, we're representing things in basic key value pairs.
Sure.
Now, if you want to build resources and you want to troubleshoot and dive deep into things, yeah, your familiarity with, you know, PowerShell and scripting in general need to be at a little bit higher level. But to kind of kick the tires and get familiar with and to just interact with desired state configuration as an API, as a tool that you're using to model out a system, you don't really need to be that in depth in PowerShell to make that happen.
I had a conversation with Don Jones a few months back, and he argued that if you've never learned PowerShell, now is the perfect time to go into DSC and learn this subset of PowerShell, just that is the pieces you need to do DSC in a serious way, because it's got a clear set of missions, you know, things you need to do. The set of commands is smaller. Like, it's a great place to start.
Yeah, it's a constrained surface area. Mm-hmm. You have a problem domain of configuration management. And so you're going to be, you know, because when you talk about approaching PowerShell, you know, am I talking about PowerShell for Active Directory?
Right, which is where I started, right? I mean, that was problem one for me coming back to the early days of PowerShell was I have hundreds of domain users and I want to make changes efficiently. But I also would argue, I mean, I came up from a programming background, so I think I was a little less afraid of piping than most people. But yeah. It was also a place where you could make a serious mess of your system if you made mistakes. Not an easy spot to start at with PowerShell.
Right. And not everybody starts with Active Directory.
Right.
So, this is a challenge for people when they're presenting about basic PowerShell and introducing people to PowerShell concepts is I can show you the awesome power of PowerShell by piping, you know, setting some Active Directory commands up together to set a bunch of properties on, you know, hundreds or thousands of users.
Sure.
And, you know, people who are familiar with Active Directory and have gone through the UIs, clicking through things,
oh, man,
are going to be like, oh, wow, that is like the best thing since sliced bread.
Oh, yeah, no, the skies open up, sunshine is shining, right up until you knock everybody off the network because you removed a critical privilege.
But the guy who focuses on IIS all day?
Yeah.
Doesn't really care.
No, different thing.
that did nothing for me.
Yeah.
And so, or SQL Server is my area of focus. I don't really care how many Active Directory users you can twiddle.
Yeah.
I need to set up a bunch of permissions on a bunch of SQL servers. And
which, let me tell you, PowerShell and SQL Server just don't get along that well.
It's a rough experience.
Well, they've got their own querying language. And that's other shows I've done a few months back where we were talking about it. You know, we tried it with PowerShell, these are the problems we have. Then we went back to the old DML and it worked. And, you know, there's a workaround.
Yep. Yeah. A lot of the newer features in SQL Server have some PowerShell stuff in front of it. But when you get back to like the core stuff around SQL Server,
yeah,
you know, managing databases themselves, managing the users and permissions and things like that. Yeah, you're back in T-SQL.
Well,
and
script-based management is the way SQL has always been. One would argue they needed this help least compared to what Active Directory and IIS needed back in the day.
Oh, and IIS still needs some help there.
Well, I appreciate that IIS committed, right? That everything is PowerShell first, and now the new UI sits on top of PowerShell. Like, at least they did the right thing there.
Yeah, definitely. So, but back to the idea of desired state configuration kind of being the entry point. And that is a great entry point because you have that context of, I have a task, I want to get something on my server into a particular state. And you can start with, I manage one resource.
Right.
You know, and you can kind of kick the tires and you can incrementally build what you manage mm-hmm. in desired state configuration. And so it lets you kind of grow as you get more comfort. So it is a very good entry point into exploring the PowerShell ecosystem. Now, when you get something that doesn't work, say you're using a community resource that, or even an inbox resource that isn't behaving exactly as you expect.
Yep.
Now the level of expertise needed to troubleshoot this has been kicked up a couple of notches.
Kicked up the next level.
So there is an opportunity cost to dealing with that abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can deal with it through the abstraction of desired state configuration, hey, life is great. When you have to go in and troubleshoot, things get a little tougher, and now you actually have to know things.
Yeah.
Or learn practice. Things.
Steve, give me 1 second to pay the bills, because Run As Radio is brought to you by ScriptRock, the biters of configuration drift. Configuration drift happens in every environment from 5 nodes to 5,000. ScriptRock will find and scan the configs of every node in your environment, no matter the platform, and alert you to changes happening across machines. And now, with the latest update, ScriptRock offers vulnerability scanning on all your nodes at no extra cost. Give it a try for 3 months free with the coupon code RUNASRADIO, all one word, at scriptrock.com/RUNASRADIO. Speak of configuration drift, and it appears.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and so, yeah, you know, ScriptRock, they're great guys, and the target that they're focusing on mm-hmm. it is definitely one we need to be aware of, and that's, okay, what is the current state of my environment, and where are things drifting and alerting, and being able to monitor and how that goes. Tools like Chef and desired state configuration and such help you keep and bring things back under control.
Right. ScriptRock will tell you have a problem, but what's the right way to fix it?
And it might not be something you had under configuration management to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely.
It might have been a side effect of that. So when we, for example, when you install a Windows feature, mm-hmm. sometimes it includes some sub features.
Yeah.
And so if in my configuration management, I say, install web server, and it's going to install some subset of the features for IIS. And, unless I said like include all sub features, in which case everything gets installed.
Right. Which is never a good idea. Like, you don't put on a footprint you don't need.
Right. So you install web server and you get some subset of things mm-hmm. installed, and you rely on those particular things being there. Now, what happens when somebody's troubleshooting an issue and they remove one of those components? When your configuration management runs to check, it's only looking at that is web-server present.
Right.
From my get Windows feature list.
But not necessarily the dependency tree beneath it.
Right. So you need to, you know, that might be something that, oh, now, hey, guess what? I just got alerted from ScriptRock or whatever that I'm missing a feature that I had there before.
Right.
And so now I go back into my config management and I detail, I need to have all these particular sub features as well. And even if they're all installed as part of IIS to begin with, I still need to validate that they're there as part of the maintenance of the machine.
Yeah. This comes back to the real recipe of an application's needs, right? It's not just the top level tools. It's the individual tools beneath it.
Right. And so like if I was doing a deployment script, mm-hmm. you know, I might have add Windows feature web-server.
Right.
And then that'd be fine. But when I'm talking config management, I'm thinking about checking this machine over time. And if it drifts, bringing it back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so I need to explicitly declarative configuration management.
Yep. Funny.
I need to explicitly declare every single thing I care about on the machine, not the things I don't care about, but the things I do care about.
Yeah.
And whether they're present or absent, you know, if I don't ever want to see the Active Directory administration tools on my public facing web servers, I can put a little check in for that and make sure that they are never installed.
Nice.
And, cause that's actually happened to me. That's a really unsettling feeling to log into a production facing web server and find that somebody enabled the Active Directory tools there.
Yeah.
And did somebody internally do this? Is this box been compromised? What's going on here?
Did I do this? Like, what's going on? Yeah. It's terrifying. Yeah.
So, you know, being able to positively assert that this thing should never be turned on and it should probably be removed from the image,
right,
is a good, you know, a good capability.
Well, and a monitor tool like ScriptRock then brings in this, you know, when it changed.
Yes.
You know, this tool was added at this point. You may or may not know who did it, but at least you know the moment that it happened.
Yep. Very much.
Let's talk a little bit about the relationship between PowerShell DSC and Chef as well, because I think there's a certain number of folks out there that think they're mutually exclusive.
Oh, not in the least.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Yeah. I'm fond of saying that, you know, that Chef is the best way to experience desired state configuration. I love
it. That's a great way.
And that's mainly due to the fact that I went through and I had the first production deployment of desired state configuration ever. Mm-hmm. And so I had to kind of figure out a lot of these, you know, this was before documentation existed and help was I email someone on the PowerShell team and and hopefully they'd thought of this scenario.
Right.
And for many cases, I was able to get some good answers. Other cases, you know, I just kind of had to make things up as I was going. And one of the benefits of, you know, kind of taking Chef on instead of just doing straight desired state configuration is Chef's bumped into a lot of these problems before, and right, we have some patterns around these things. And one of the core ones is how do I separate my environmental data from my structural data and so from the structural configuration. So what do I, you know, how do I take my blueprint basically for my server and separate that from the address where I'm building it?
Okay.
So maybe I'm going to build it in my dev environment, and so it's going to get a different set of settings. That I want to be able to use the same blueprint in my production environment, but just with the production settings. Mm-hmm. And so how do I exactly separate that information and structure that so that I only need to specify the things that I need to? That sounds kind of esoteric, and it's kind of tough to explain until you actually hit that problem.
Right.
And you don't bump into it in your first, you know, 10 servers that you deploy, because maybe they're all of one particular type.
Yeah.
But once you start broadening out into either multiple data centers or managing multiple types of servers or multiple applications on multiple types of servers, you start to experience the sprawl of data. And so, you know, working in the Chef ecosystem, we've got patterns around dealing with that, whether it's roles and environments or policy files. There are a couple of different constructs, and there's a number of people who've been through this process and can kind of give you some advice and direction, you know, as far as how to go.
I've also got a deep appreciation that Chef comes at this with very much a cross-platform mentality. Like, you've taken learnings from every stack, from every operating system on how to manage at scale, continuous uptime, like all of those sorts of problems. It's not just the Windows stack.
Oh, definitely. And Windows is an important part of our stack. And as new things happen, mm-hmm, you know, so desired state configuration, for example, the minute that came out, Chef started investigating how we can leverage that to make our experience on Windows better.
Nice.
So one of the great things about how we kind of pick up with desired state configuration is that we either allow you with DSC script to kind of embed a snippet of PowerShell desired state configuration, mm-hmm, which you just take the DSC syntax, or you can point to an existing configuration script that you already have, mm-hmm, and leverage that as part of your Chef run. Or we have DSC resource, which with Windows Management Framework 5, which is in production preview now and is nearing RTM based on the PowerShell team's blog post a while back with the roadmap. They were shooting for around this time of year for an RTM of Windows Management Framework 5. Mm-hmm. Or the PowerShell on Windows 10, you can actually very easily. There's a lightweight wrapper in Chef called DSC Resource that basically uses DSC resources as native Chef resources, and so you have kind of two different flavors based on how you want to go about interacting with desired state configuration, but basically everything in the DSC ecosystem, all the best parts of desired state configuration, are available to you through Chef.
Nice.
The only part that's not is the hard part of actually separating out that, building out that structure of how we want our systems to look. And so that's why I kind of think that, you know, the best way to experience DSC is through Chef. And that's in large part due to the pain that I had in my first go at doing desired state configuration by itself on Windows.
just being able to keep those two pieces separate so that you can manage all this.
Yeah.
It's so much of this feels like these are on-prem problems. Like, don't a bunch of these issues go away once we're in the cloud and machines are effectively uniform because they're all VMs?
No. I mean, if you just look at like a starting place, like say you take something like CloudFormation or mm-hmm. or Azure RM,
right?
You know, where, hey, spin me up an environment that looks like X.
Right. Fire off this template.
Yep. That's kind of back to golden images and VM templates.
Yes, it is.
Right. And so we have a starting place. We still have to get to where we're actually deploying our application or managing the system. And depending on how you run those systems, if you run them over time, then it's just like running a server in the data center.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
If you're cycling these things out and, you know, they're kind of ephemeral servers, you spin them up when you need them, you tear them down when you don't, you deploy onto new, fresh things, and you're fully embracing that cloud model.
Yeah.
You still need to, you're not necessarily going to be creating full baked images exactly like you want for every deployment. You might. That's the Netflix model. But
and this is the thing that I've started to see. Like when I think about Chef, I think about these are recipes that run several times a day. Every time we do a full up regression test, we're lighting up multiple instances of the entire infrastructure off of a Chef set of recipes and then running the tests. And when we're ready for a full deploy, we push out the deploy that way too. Like I don't know of a VM in some of my customers that lives longer than 3 hours.
Yep. And What might be running at the start of that 3 hours might be slightly different than what's running at the end of that 3 hours, but you still need to be able to spin up and bring those machines into compliance.
Yes.
And it maybe you're doing the baked image kind of idea that like I said, Netflix does, where we just ship machine images, we spin them up, and then when we need to change something, we ship a new machine image.
Right.
But you still need to build those machine images up in a way.
Yes.
And you need to manage the configuration of those base images. And so Chef kind of fits into that story as well. And, we're talking a lot about the configuration management side of Chef, but Chef is, at least we like to think of it more of as an automation platform. It's not just single node configuration management. We also have tools like Chef Provisioning, mm-hmm. which help you manage a set of resources. And so you could actually, so Chef Provisioning is just a recipe. It's our Chef domain specific language now to describe models of infrastructure, not just servers and not just the state of that individual server. So you can use that same syntax that you would to configure a node to say, okay, I need 5 web servers, 2 database servers, mm-hmm. spin up the database servers first, then do the web servers, spin up a couple of caching nodes, and apply, these are the policies you apply to them.
Yeah.
And I always want to have at least 5 web servers running. I want to have at least 2 caching servers, a couple of database servers, and that's the environment. And if you want to be really tricky, you could actually make that policy part of the run list for each of the nodes in it. And now each node is responsible for managing that infrastructure. And if any one of them notice like that, oh, hey, web server's not responding, let's spin up a new one. And you could actually make it kind of a self-healing infrastructure.
Yeah.
But that's kind of going down the crazy town route.
But but I like crazy town.
But it's a very interesting, it's something interesting to play with conceptually and see if, you know, having a self-healing infrastructure is really possible.
Yeah. I mean, something crippled that web server in the first place that caused your self-healing to start up a new one. I mean, what's going to stop the next one from dying, the next one dying? Like I've seen that behavior where you just have this endless cascade of creates and deaths.
Yep. And that's where, you know, configuration management does not exist in a vacuum.
Sure.
You have to have some sort of centralized of error logging and event logging. So, you know, maybe it's a central syslog server or Windows event log forwarding or Splunk or Logstash and Kibana.
Yeah. Instrumentation is important here.
Right.
Because it will do dumb things if you let it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And then continuing kind of up the stack, we've recently announced some offerings in the compliance and audit space. Mm-hmm. And so Chef Client actually has audit mode built in. So you can actually run, validations of your system state as part of the, at, after your chevron runs, so you can continually watch for drift from compliance. So if you have to meet PCI or CIS compliance or something like that, that becomes part of your capability as part of your config management, as well as standalone scanning.
I mean, this is effectively just in a test suite.
It is. It's a test suite, but it's in a language that allows you to in almost a natural language mode that allows you to use auditors audit and compliance terminology, right, and things that map to your controls to define the tests.
So this is part of Chef Analytics?
This is part of Chef Compliance.
Okay.
And then audit mode is a capability just of Chef Client of the open source product. Compliance is part of our service offering.
Okay.
But that was a very recent announcement. We announced that back in beginning of November.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of, you know, one of the ways that we're kind of moving up the stack. And then Chef Delivery, we announced this past spring. That's our kind of opinionated, you know, delivery pipeline that we've built out with a number of customers. And so it's a build and deployment pipeline for environments, not just in applications and configuration management as part of the same pipeline.
Nice.
So, you know, while we focus our discussion kind of on the config management side of things, there's more happening in the Chef ecosystem than just config management.
Absolutely. Well, and it's nice to think in these macro levels too of what continuous deployment looks like, what delivery really looks like, what audit looks like. So that it's just part of a routine set of compliance practices.
Well, because all these things come up the minute you start talking about config management. It's like, Right. Okay, well, so how do we get that config management delivered?
Right.
I'm in a heavily regulated environment. How do I want to, or how can I take advantage of this configuration management stuff and make changes frequently, but still meet my audit and compliance needs for my environment?
Sure. Still have the evidence necessary for an audit to pass.
Yep. And so, you know, especially as we see more enterprise adoption of Chef, this is kind of the direction that things are pushing where Chef, the language, and Chef, the configuration management tool, become enablers of a lot of these other scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Now you sound more like a CIO than a developer.
You know, what's funny is, you know, this DevOps space, it's a lot about communicating with others.
Sure.
And so you have these conversations and you start talking about, we start talking about config management. Maybe we get down dirty and technical for a little while.
Yeah.
And then we start moving up the stack and we start talking about, okay, how does this fit into the rest of things? And it forces you to have these broader conversations.
A bit of a global mindset on overall software delivery.
Yes. And so I think it kind of broadens the range of things you start to care about, which is totally a DevOps concept.
Yeah, no, it's such a good thing for the organization.
Right. You care about more than just your little thing that you focus on.
I agree.
And the delivery of things as a whole and the operations of the business as a whole.
Well, this is great, Stephen. I really appreciate seeing where Chef's going as well as, you know, what we've been good at all this time. So it's nice to see this continuing to evolve.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Richard. I love talking with you.
Well, thanks, man. And thanks so much for coming back on the show. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Anytime.
All right. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.